Right, here we go. Welcome back to Red Eyes Radio. We are talking with Andrew D. Bashago, and we have much material to cover, of course, in regards to Mars, and we want to get cracking on that as soon as possible. But Andrew, you just had two points here again that you want to mention a little bit more in regards to the Bill Richardson question and also to David Wilcock. But please go ahead and tell us what you wanted to say more there about Bill Richardson.
Right. Well, I mentioned how, you know, I stand by my claim that Bill Richardson was a young staffer on Project Pegasus, and that I first met him in the summer of 1970 when he was taking roll, when as a group of young teleportees, we were alighting on the State Capitol Complex grounds there in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and he was responsible for taking us inside the building there, which was the Bataan Memorial Building, which indeed was the visual hallmark that we were looking for when we popped into view in Santa Fe. And not only that, but that he was spoken of as a future governor of New Mexico as a result of the project circulating these intelligence reports, when different things that the Defense Department knew about the future as a result of its quantum access capability that was then emerging in the early 70s had gathered about future events. There was even laughter around the lunch table one time when they made reference to, you know, young Bill, one of the staffers on, 25-year-old staffers on the project becoming governor of the state. And I also met with Bill Richardson, and I'm grateful for the help that he provided to me during my June 2003 fact-finding trip to New Mexico. He was really the highest placed U.S. government official that thus far agreed to meet with me. And he essentially told me that he supported my investigation and the efforts I was making, but that it would be politically untenable to publicly, do a press conference with me, at least at that point, and affirm what he knew about what the U.S. government had achieved in the area of applied quantum physics by 1970 when he was a staff on the project, because there was no context for the public to understand what he would be talking about in such a press conference. But I just wanted to say in regard to this listener comment, you know, Bill Richardson has had a career in which he has been the congressman from the 3rd District, which is where the United States' most sensitive defense labs are, basically where its atomic war-making capability was developed. He has been governor of the state of New Mexico, which is essentially one big military reservation. There have been trillions of dollars of the defense dollars spent in New Mexico since the Manhattan Project was placed there in 1943-44. And Bill Richardson has also been Energy Secretary of the United States under President Clinton. And so among contemporary public officials in the United States, he has been as involved in the secret defense work in New Mexico as any other. And so my point here is that when I'm alleging that he was a young staffer on the project, I wasn't alleging that he was from New Mexico, that he grew up there, that he didn't have a career in baseball, or that he wasn't a Boston Yankee. Those may all be parts of his biography. I was simply stating that when he was supposed to be somewhere else, namely working as a young legislative aide to a Republican congressman, he in fact was in Santa Fe playing the support role for Project Pegasus. I didn't say that's when he began his career in New Mexico, but I want to make a broader point, and that is we have to be more discerning about the way in which the military-industrial intelligence complex has secretly governed our public affairs since the Manhattan Project, since the advent of the atomic age, because the atomic age brought with it the threat of total destruction of our planetary civilization, at least widespread annihilation and destruction of targets, for example, in the United States and in the former Soviet Union. And I think that when I provide so much information about what Project Pegasus did and I link Bill Richardson, I think the responsibly discerning thing is to say, you know, it would make sense for the permanent secret government of the United States to develop a particular public official to play that role of the congressman from the 3rd District, the governor of New Mexico.
Of course.
Energy Secretary of the United States, because you've got trillions of defense dollars that are being spent there not only on building the next generation of nuclear weapons, but also the very applications in applied quantum physics that I'm trying to bring to public light. And so I think that at this point in history, essentially it's a self-induced diversion from reality to say, well, he couldn't have been a young staffer on the secret defense project that Andy's describing because he was playing baseball. I mean, ultimately, I don't mean to be unkind to this listener, but think of the implications of that. We're talking about the person who has been most intimately associated during his public political career with trillions of dollars of defense spending in New Mexico, the need to shepherd them through the federal government, you know, through Congress, through the president, and also just to earn the consent of the people of New Mexico, who, I might add, have been injured by such defense research and development activities, because not only is New Mexico essentially one big federally funded military reservation, it's contaminated with the fissile products of the nuclear development projects that have been undertaken there. New Mexico has one of the highest cancer rates in the United States as a result of it being widely polluted by the defense activities that have been undertaken there. And so I just want to kind of apply some reality here and say, well, look, Bill Richardson is somebody with a background, a provenance as a public official. And that background has been as somebody who has always been associated with the flow of defense dollars into the state of New Mexico. It's irrelevant that, you know, he's the son of an Anglo-Saxon diplomat from Boston and a Mexican mother. I'm not alleging that he was some native son of New Mexico that I met during those years. In fact, as I mentioned during the first hour here of this broadcast, I have stated in several interviews that it was his first introduction to New Mexico. And so, and also that my research indicates that he wasn't playing baseball at that time. He was, even though he became a very prominent Democrat, in fact, has ran for president during the last presidential election cycle here in the United States in 2008, he was working for a Republican congressman at that time. And as I previously articulated, Project Pegasus was basically staffed with Nixon Republicans. Donald Rumsfeld, my father, everybody on, you know, Ivan Browning was a Republican. Everybody attached to the project was essentially a Nixon Republican. Mm-hmm. And what do you know, during that summer, Bill Richardson was working for a Nixon Republican congressman. So that's the true account, and I'm aware of the fact that he's not a native New Mexican, but he's really the most prominent New Mexico politician of the last 40 years, and I'm simply providing an entry in his biography that hasn't been shared with the public. And I'm very sensitive about this issue because I'm going to be calling on him to ultimately embrace my claim that the U.S. government did develop teleportation 40 years ago. And I also view him as one of the white hats of my investigation because he had a lot to lose by meeting with me back in June 2003. And I think he showed real personal and political courage, real decency as a human being by meeting with me briefly and explaining his position to me. And so I just wanted to sort of address him again and sort of clarify the fact that his involvement in the project is among data points, it's one of the best established because I was able to meet with him in 2003 and verify my own memories that he was a young staffer on the project.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. How about you wanted to comment a little bit more about the David Wilcock comment as well?
Well, I mentioned how I first sort of laughed at it, and then I realized that it was emanating from different postings on the internet, including a very bizarre YouTube posting where I think it may actually be an urban legend that's sort of being propagated as an informational ploy. I mentioned during the top hour of your show that I thought it may have been an attempt to maybe get under my skin a little bit and try to pique my egotism by saying, well, this person's just emerging around this discourse, but what do you know, he's somebody else. And, you know, I'll just let that roll down my shoulders like, you know, spring rain. But the thing is that what I wanted to say is the reason I think it may be a disinformational ploy is the fact that it allows them to use the word hoax. You notice in this posting that the listener said, why is this hoax being perpetrated? And so one theory I'm having as to why this urban legend that states that David Wilcock and I are the same person, which we most certainly are not, is that my Mars data is supported, you know, my Mars allegations, my Mars findings are supported both by highly specific photographic data and very assiduously worded text. Typically, when somebody propagates a hoax, whether it's in parascience or parapolitics or just in everyday societal discourse, there's very little factual substantiation of what they're claiming. Most hoaxes are based on mere allegation. And what distinguishes my Mars work is it's substantial. I mean, my Mars paper is 41 pages, single-spaced, and it's certainly as dense as any, let's say, Scientific American or National Geographic or Nature or Discover article around similar material. It may be a little fanciful in places, but I wrote it that way so that it would be accessible to school children. But I think the reason that this particular urban legend may have been propagated is it allows them to use the word hoax, even though there's very little handhold in my work to allege that my work is a hoax. It's too substantial to be a hoax. It's too self-authenticating and too complex to be a hoax. And so I think that this bizarre notion that I'm somebody else may have been introduced simply to say, why is this hoax being perpetrated? Because everybody who brings up the David Wilcock claim, directing both callers during radio interviews that I've done, individuals who wrote Jessica Mystic after she interviewed me on YouTube, and now one of your listeners, the word hoax is always used. And so that's what I think that the David Wilcock meme, the David Wilcock disinformation ploy that's being run, is really probably just a carrier signal so that the allegation, the disparagement, the aspersion that my work is a hoax can be stated, because there's very little room to do so otherwise. You know, I'm publishing photographs. For example, my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, has several photographs of different details from NASA image 10214, PIA 10214, that is, of humanoids on Mars. And almost a year has passed, and we haven't had any recognition in the mainstream media that photographs of humanoids on another celestial body have been published on the Internet.
No, you're never going to get that in the mainstream media, but go ahead.
Well, I mean, in order to hoax that, I would have to be some expert in claymation, and I'm not. I'm a lawyer. Okay, so it sounds like something from Star Trek, right? You know,
right.
I'm a doctor, not a miracle worker. You know, I'm a lawyer. I don't know anything about how to hoax anything. I have such diminished vision at this point. I have 2,500 vision in both eyes. I can't even take photographs through a conventional digital camera. So, I mean, the notion that I could have hoaxed something photographically is just, it's absurd. But again, the reason I think that they've invented this peculiar urban legend that I'm somebody else, namely David, is so that they can use the word hoax, because they can't do it relying on my work.
Right. And absolutely, Andrew, I understand that. And it's also, on top of that, to add to that, obviously, is that you also bring forward an incredible story, and it is going to be examined from all angles, and people are going to try to find holes in it, obviously. So in one event as well is that it's also good that it's being examined, right? Which means that if it's legit, it will stand up to the critiques and the points that are being carried forward. So ultimately, there's nothing negative to it. I think in one way it might be something more behind it, just as you say, but at the same time, I also think that people inherently are suspicious to it and want to try to keep their distance in a way, if you know what I mean, a little bit to the information, and try to, meander around it a little bit before they kind of incorporate it and accept it as their truth, if you know what I mean.
Yes, absolutely. I think that it could also be a psychological ploy, a kind of a displacement to say, well, I don't want to believe this information because of its implications, so I'm going to adhere to a popular story indicating that something else is going on. I think the analogy there would be, let's say, the aspersions that were cast at Mr. Lincoln when he arrived at the U.S. presidency in such an unexpected way. There were allegations that he was actually a monkey, I mean, because of his appearance. So I think I'm an auguste company in this area of bizarre allegations.
All right.
But yes, I think it may be a psychological ploy of some kind that they're simply avoiding the fact that I'm showing that Mars is inhabited, and that's fraught with all kinds of implications that we haven't even considered.
Absolutely, and here on this program, we're primarily interested in hearing your testimony, so to speak, hearing about your research, and then ultimately, as always, we'll leave up the decision-making to the audience, obviously. But so with that being said, with you adding a few of your comments to these two issues, why don't we go into the Mars area now then, and maybe you can tell us a bit about, I guess, the overlap, so to speak, between Project Pegasus and when the Mars issues, so to speak, or when Mars kind of came into the picture, Andrew?
Right. Well, we addressed this back during the first broadcast, and so let me just briefly reframe that for your listeners of this broadcast. The overlap between my experiences on Project Pegasus as one of America's early time space explorers, essentially, as a child attached to the U.S. time space exploration program at the time of its emergence, is data related to my later Mars findings, findings that I would make in adulthood, in fact, in my mid to late 40s, were shared with me as early as age 6 and 7. I described a set of experiences where I was given prior knowledge of my Mars findings. And this was not papers that were written by the government. This was my actual paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, as I wrote it and published it in 2008. So let me just briefly articulate what those moments of where the intelligence community worked with me to provide me prior knowledge or foreknowledge of my Mars findings. The first incident I described was when I, in 1967-68, right around the time that my father and I first started teleporting to New Mexico and back from New Jersey. My father was then working for Parsons Jordan, which was a subsidiary of the Ralph M. Parsons Company. It had a single contract, which was a copper contract with Anaconda in Chile. And that was being used, as I found later in my experiences in Project Pegasus and in my research, mining projects and old school sites were being used as covers for Project Pegasus because they allowed defense contractors to control basically derelict locations that were outside the gaze of the public. And so my dad comes home to our home in Mars Plains, New Jersey from his employment at Parsons Jordan in downtown, New York City. And he gathered us around. I was the youngest of five children. My siblings were all right around the same age. The five children in my family were all born between 1956 and 61 because two of them are twins. So my mom had, five pregnancies in the late 50s, or four pregnancies there with five kids in the late 50s and early 60s. I was the youngest. I was born in 1961. And so this was around 1967-68. I remember my dad, comes home from work. I believe he was still with Parsons Jordan at that time and had not yet been hired by the Ralph M. Parsons Company per se. That occurred in 1969 when I was placed in Project Pegasus, coincidentally. But he gathered us around after dinner. He was somewhat inebriated. My dad was certainly not an alcoholic. He was a very basically abstemious and responsible man and a great father, a very responsible human being at that, and a wonderful dad. And he said, listen to this, children. This writer is writing about the first discovery of life forms on planet Mars. And for about a half hour after dinner, we sat around in our living room in New Jersey, and he became hysterical, and we were laughing, because what he was reading were some of the most fanciful passages from my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars, which I would not write until 2008. And something, as he concluded, my mother said, okay, that's enough, hon, you're laughing too hard. I mean, he became hysterical, and we were really laughing because the way he was reading it was truly funny. So this was a happy moment, right? And, but something was triggered, and I ran up to him, and I did something that I've never done before or since, and that he chastised me for doing. I pulled what he was reading out of his hand, and what it was a manila folder in which was stapled a document that said Central Intelligence Agency, and then it said memorandum. There was cursive writing across the top that said Central Intelligence Agency, and then the word memorandum. And it said, Andrew Bushtago, The Discovery of Life on Mars, 2008. And it said something like synopsis or something. But it wasn't a synopsis of my paper. It was basically a bowdlerized set of excerpts of the most ludicrous parts of my paper. The passages that a critic or a cynic or a skeptic would take to discredit my paper as tomfoolery. In other words, they took the passages that were the most descriptive, the most childlike, the most fanciful, and that's all that was in there. It was almost like a comedic newspaper column, if a Jimmy Breslin or a Mike Royko or an Art Buchwald had talked about his trip to Mars and what he saw there. So they basically excised all of the few silly passages that I included to make my work accessible to, school kids. And that's what my father was reading. And when I wrenched it out of his hand, he was shocked, and he said, don't ever do that. And he wrenched it out of my hand. But I was able to quickly read that it was some kind of intelligence file on Central Intelligence Agency letterhead, in which some intelligence analyst had had access to my paper and had passed along passages to my father in this briefing document that were highly unrepresentative of, or misrepresentative, I should say, of what my paper as published ultimately constituted. The second incident was about a year later, around 1969. My dad was giving me a haircut up in the study on the third floor of our house. He used to take the kitchen stool up there, kitchen chair, and he would put an apron around us and give us, you know, a haircut, like a crew cut of that era. And we had a large family, you know, so we were always trying to do the prudent thing and not, you know, in this case, he was providing a haircut rather than having to pay for it for his, you know, three sons. Mm. And during that, when he sat me down in the chair and put the apron around me to cut my hair, he went over to an area of the study there where he put something on one of our desks. He had made five desks for us to do our homework at. My dad was very handy. He was an excellent carpenter. He made these beautiful desks for us. And he opened one of the drawers and he took out a manila envelope that had a red wax seal and a tie string, but it had already been opened. So he undid the tie string and he pulled out a single page, and it had a single image on it. And what that image was the photographic detail of a Martian humanoid that is in my paper, The Discovery of Life on Mars. Now, that humanoid can be seen on an area that we're calling the rock enclosure. It's an intentionally assembled group of rocks. At least one of them is intentionally assembled. In fact, it has a carving of a solar-like face on it that is in the right middle portion of Silkovsky Ridge, which can be found in the left middle distance of NASA image PIA-10214. That is one of the several humanoids that I discovered in that image. And my father showed me the image and said, "Do you know what this is?" And I said, "No, what?" He said, "It's a Martian." And I said, "It is?" And he said, "Yeah." And he said, "Guess who find?" And I said, "Really?" And he goes, "Yeah, a Martian. It's a humanoid on Mars." And I said, "Really?" And he said, "Guess who finds it?" And I said, "Who?" And he goes, "You do. So take a look at it." And then he put it away. So he was showing me that detail from PIA-10214, which I'm alleging basically is the most significant data to be published in that paper. That is the first image of a humanoid in its natural state living on another planet ever to be published in the world. And here we are, October of 2009, and that hasn't even made the major periodicals yet, much less the leading newspapers in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's in fact what it is. And clearly, because of its quantum access capability, that image was sourced from the future and was in the possession of the Central Intelligence Agency when I was a small school child. Okay, that was 40 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was now 1968-69. So that was 41 years ago. My own father had a copy of that photographic detail. And that shows that they prioritized my Mars findings in their effort to gather data about past and future events. Okay, now the third incident was in 1970. My father said, "Come on, Andy, we're going over to Curtis Wright." And we jumped in his station wagon. And when we were in the car, and my siblings and, you know, friends in the neighborhood couldn't hear what we were talking about, I said, "Are we teleporting to Mars? Are we teleporting to New Mexico?" Mm. And he said, "No, there's some Martians over there, and they want to meet you." And during that whole trip from our home in Mars Plains over to Curtis Wright in Woodridge, New Jersey, I really couldn't get my mind around what he was talking about, you know, that there were Martians there. So we walked into a hangar there, and as we entered the hangar, there was like a loading dock, and then the rest of the hangar was about 8 feet lower. And right at the lip of that stage was a silver craft that looked like a very shiny teardrop-shaped automobile that was hovering next to the stage. It was like going putt, 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 and just staying afloat there. But I could hear it, and it was hovering there. And it was not a flying saucer. It was some kind of high-performance craft that the Martians apparently had arrived in. Okay. So we went over to the left where there was one of those minimal little offices, just like you have at the space launch facilities where the astronauts, you know, on a space shuttle will like grab their last cup of coffee before getting on the ship.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a rudimentary office with folding chairs and a rudimentary table. And there were three men sitting there. There were two other men from Curtis Wright there and my father. So we went into that room. There were two humans there over on the far side of the table. And on the right side of the table, about ready to leave, sort of like finishing a briefing, were three humanoids that looked essentially human. They were bald. One of the three had a little bit of hair on the back of his head, kind of a male pattern baldness thing going. But the other two were completely bald. They were wearing tight-fitting silver suits with a blood red, a kind of a crimson red badge on the front. In other words, like a pentagonal image on the chest, a crest with a yellow lightning bolt going through it. And they finished a technical discussion with those two humans, you know, from the aerospace community at that table. And then we left. My dad and I exited first because we had entered the room last. And then they walked past me. And the third one stopped and turned to my father. You notice they were walking in kind of an unusual way. They didn't have the same gait as modern human beings. So they were walking slightly differently. And I noticed their muscles were deposited on different parts of their skeletal system in a slightly different way. In other words, their body type was a little different, but still essentially human. And the third one stopped and said to my father, he said, "Ray, it was a pleasure visiting your beautiful planet again, and it was great to see you again. Thank you for introducing us to your young son, Andy." So what he said seemed to confirm what my father said when we jumped in the car, which is that the Martians knew something about me and had actually asked to meet me. Maybe it was because the U.S. government's knowledge of the later role that I would play in history regarding the revelation of life on Mars had been shared with the Martians during their liaison with our aerospace community. That's how I think it fell together. I don't think there was some non-ordinary basis for the Martians to know who I was or Mars history. Okay. So they walked past, and then they got into their ship, and they putted out of the hangar, and then they slowly did a big loping circle around the tarmac. And one of the two engineers from the room was now on my right, and he said, "Now watch this, Andy." And the Martians came around one more time, and when they got on the straightaway there on the tarmac, they went from about 20 miles per hour or 40 miles per hour, I couldn't really tell. But, you know, they're going fairly fast, like a car, but then they went, that must have been from like 4,000 to 8,000 to like 12,000 miles per hour, like in a second and a half. It just zipped off the tarmac. It was the most remarkable technical feat that I've ever seen. They just soared off of that tarmac. And I remember on the way home, my father made a number of comments that he said a couple of things. He said he had been asked to study their mathematics, and he couldn't understand it because in their notational system, 2 + 2 = 5. And I now, since we know they have an underground civilization, if you're building things like ceilings that you're hoping to keep the surface of your planet off your head, you know, from crushing you, 4 posts is going to create a ceiling that you can use for the fifth element, which is the plane to keep your ceiling up. Okay, so maybe that explains it. But he said their math does not make sense. The other thing he said that we've taken them out on field trips around Curtis Wright, and in one incident they spent about a half hour examining some weeds that were clumped together on the ground. And now when I, as a Mars, you know, researcher, when I look at how relatively devoid of life Mars is, that would make sense. If they're the human beings that have survived in the almost sterile, austere environment of Mars, where there's limited water and limited vegetation, and where there's mass predation going on between competing species, they would really have to be able to study their natural environment to survive and evolve as humanoids. But he said that they were just transfixed by just some common cluster of leaves after a rainstorm and wondering what it all meant. You know, they have the oak leaf attached to the maple leaf here. Okay, so they were just scrutinizing these leaves, and so that was kind of bizarre. The other comment they made is that he said, "I don't know how three guys can remain cooped up in such a small ship because it takes them 24 hours to get home. So I still have to do the math on the distance to Mars or the average distance, let's say, and then figure out how fast they were going when they left the tarmac there." Because it was a conventional craft, but it was, I would guess, at least 4,000 miles per hour. It just soared off of that tarmac. So this third incident was sort of an acclimation where I was being let in a little bit into that inner sanctum of basically extraterrestrial human liaison going on around that time in our aerospace community. They were there on some kind of technical liaison mission. And I know that's the case because when we entered the briefing room, they were talking shop, and I couldn't follow any of it. It was all technical. So I can confirm that the humanoids on Mars that resemble us or that are essentially our long-lost relatives that remained up there after the solar system catastrophe of 9500 BC have already been here. They were there in a very advanced craft. And so we know that underground civilization on Mars that includes the humanoids like us is more advanced than us, just as Courtney Brown's team found at Emory University when they remotely viewed Mars. They found that Martian civilization is 150 years beyond human civilization on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Then getting to the 1971, sorry.
I just one note there. Do you know if these particular Martians who you met with, if they in some instance represented their military force or their government, or what was this just to, what do we call civilians, or what was the relationship, so to speak, or what were they there for? Do you know that?
I believe they were astronauts of that civilization who, like many of our astronauts, were PhDs in science and engineering who were there on an aerospace liaison project,
mm-hmm.
probably to perform technology transfer from their civilization to ours. And my guess there would be an Earth-Mars collaboration to establish an extraterrestrial defense posture. That would be my guess.
Really?
But they were clearly, they were at least astronauts. I mean, they had specialized clothing with an emblem on it.
Yes.
So, and also they were talking shop with aerospace engineers working for Curtis Wright. And, you know, most of what my dad did, for example, at the Edison Labs from 1956 to 64 was solving high-end math problems in the development of the electronic components that were coming out of those labs in New Jersey during the 50s and 60s that ultimately were purchased by Robert Noyce of Intel Corporation, and that became the personal computer revolution.
Hmm.
So my father was a BSEE, having graduated from Lehigh University in 1951. He was admitted to Eta Kappa Nu, the Engineering Honor Society. So these wouldn't be, you know, leading American scientists, but they would be certainly American aerospace engineers who were capable of higher-end math and engineering work.
Right.
And so these would have been literally some of the actual aerospace engineers, for example, developing high-performance aircraft for the U.S. military.
Hmm.
Because it was at Curtis Wright where my father had helped design the metal alloy so that the ramjet wouldn't melt when it was in our atmosphere from friction.
How was their how was their English, by the way? Did they speak with an accent, or was it perfect English, or how did you communicate?
The diction was perfect. It was, in fact, an American accent. It didn't even have a British accent. It was, he said, just as I'm saying it now, he said, it was a pleasure visiting your beautiful planet. It sounded just like a newscaster would sound in the U.S.
Really?
His voice was very high-pitched.
Hmm.
It was coming through a native speaker of American English, standard American English, had just breathed helium. It was a very high pitch. And that's also one of the things we discussed on the way home. I said, why are their voices so high? And he said, because they've evolved in an atmosphere with less oxygen in it. And the high oxygen content of our atmosphere affects their vocal cords the same way that helium affects ours. So It was unaccented American English, but it was in a very high-pitched tone of voice.
Interesting. So this was your first encounter, pretty much, with the Martian humanoids or the Martians. What happened consequently after this, and how did you end up? I guess we're coming there, but this is one of the main points I want to talk with you about as well, and that is basically how you ended up on Mars eventually, how you got there, so to speak.
Well, that remains somewhat of a mystery, but there were a couple other important events that occurred still when I was a child, and one was that when I was in Albuquerque as a child attached to Project Pegasus. I mentioned in the previous hour on today's show how there was a lot of downtime spent, particularly in Albuquerque, particularly hanging out with Connie Chavez at the restaurant where she worked. And we know all the people there, Wentworth Brown and so forth, you know, who were regulars there who were running that restaurant. And there was one incident in the summer of 1971. This would have been where I had teleported to New Mexico and spent the whole summer there. And then at the end of the summer, teleported back to New Jersey on the day I left. So when I say summer of 1971, for me, it was the first summer of 1971. And then I lived a second summer of 71 in New Jersey. When I was attached to Pegasus, I essentially spent four time loops, four extra summers during those 3 years in New Mexico. Because at the end of that set of experiences, that summer in New Mexico, they were looping back. So I spent parts of the summer of 1970, 71, 72, and 73 in New Mexico, accessing it via the teleport at Curtis Wright in Woodridge, New Jersey. But then when those experiences ended, those blocks of special project activities, training, time travel to the past, time travel to the future, to 2045, and all the activities that I'm going to be describing in my book, we were always teleporting back to the day we left. So from my alpha timeline on New Jersey, those were time loops that branched off, but I still continued to have a normal set of experiences in New Jersey.
Right.
And during one of the time loops, the first summer of 1971, my dad, Connie Chavez had been essentially babysitting me at the restaurant. She had been just watching over me while my dad was gone when I had a project meeting, because I wasn't privy to all of the project meetings. I was at the project meeting where they described how the kids would teleport there and then teleport to past and future events and then teleport back to New Mexico and then teleport back to New Jersey on the day we left. But I wasn't privy to all of the technical meetings on the project. In fact, I was present at very few of them. My dad would frequently drop me off, and Connie would just sort of supervise me when she was doing her work at the restaurant. And I would sit there and read a book or play solitaire or whatever. Sometimes just sit at the table and just look out at, into space. I was basically bored a lot of times when I was on the project, but believe it or not. Anyway, so my father came back to the restaurant, and he was so agitated that his upper eyelid was twitching, which would always happen for my father when he was really agitated about something, really concerned. And he said something to Connie that indicated that at some point I do something very provocative. I think it may be my rollout of information about Pegasus. Maybe it'll be the public appeal for Secretary Rumsfeld and Governor Richardson to step forward and affirm my claims. But there was something that my dad had learned that he had just learned. Maybe he had just been briefed on the fact that I was destined to be one of the principal whistleblowers regarding the U.S. development of a quantum access capability under Project Pegasus, in what we were then involved in. But he was very, very concerned. He was concerned almost as if my life was in danger. And she became concerned because she loved my father, and she evinced a motherly concern for me. She had been babysitting me essentially for years when we were in New Mexico on a special project basis. In fact, when I talk about teleporting there in 1967-68, when I was a six-year-old, to attend that meeting with Dr. Harold M. Agnew when he was director of the W Division at the Los Alamos Labs, I'm not certain whether there was one previous trip to New Mexico when I was about four, because Connie was definitely a figure in my life from a very young age. In fact, I had mentioned her a couple of times to my mother, and she didn't know what I was talking about. I was talking about her as Aunt Connie from a very young age, because that's how she had originally been introduced to me by my dad. So Connie became concerned because my dad was concerned, and she could see he was agitated. And she blurted out in front of me, "Is this around the time that he finds all that stuff up on Mars?" And my dad kind of scowled and sort of scolded her, because every time a future data was shared with the person that was implicated in the data, it was supposed to be vetted with the project. In other words, everything that was shared with somebody was an intelligence community function, right? Mm-hmm. It was fraught with significance. So when he was having apparently, heart-to-heart conversations with her, he had asked her not to blurt stuff out in front of me.
Right.
And he was again chastising her for just blabbing about something in front of me, because the threat of revealing future information to somebody is that the refraction between the ultimate event and their foreknowledge may cause the event to misfire in some way.
Mm.
In the same way that the butterfly effect occurs, at least on a micro level, when you jump back to your alpha timeline from a beta timeline, you can't get the person exactly at the right second, the right nanosecond in the original timeline, because that requires a degree of subatomic mastery that we didn't possess at that time. We were working in these gross translations between timelines where there was a little offset when I would get back to New Jersey. Like, my sister would challenge me, "Well, you never talked about that." In other words, there were always these little offsets, these little empirical distortions. I knew I was back with my loved ones and my school classmates and living in the same town and going to the same school. But there were a couple incidents where when I did teleport back to Curtis Wright, there were slight changes in what had occurred. You know, somebody had moved out of the community when I don't remember that having happened.
Mm.
Some child had been injured or something. In other words, there were slight offsets that I think were attributable to the fact that they weren't sticking us back in exactly the same timeline, but a slightly adjacent one.
That's a little bit tricky, isn't it? That could upset things if, you try to grasp for reality in one sense and find a, central node point, so to speak. But did that affect you as well, emotionally and psychologically, that you couldn't kind of pin down reality in a way almost?
It didn't bother me in the slightest when I perceived it. I thought, well, something weird is going on here, because a conversation I had with one of my siblings or something was suddenly forgot by them. And I kind of wrote it off to the fact that they were still my siblings, but clearly I knew that we were having some offset. So it was almost as if I was returning to 99.99% the same reality, but there was always that 0.01 distortion that I just pretty much just wrote off to experience. It really didn't alarm me, but I definitely detected it when I was on the project. And then later in 1980, they had me jump between Van Nuys and Los Alamos and back to try to correct quantum slippage that was actually occurring, because on one of the nights, my dad had failed to get me through the teleport at Sandia before 9 p.m. There was like a witching hour that had passed. And so they knew by my junior high school years in Southern California that I was quantum slipping. I'd have these experiences where I'd be putting my books in my locker during the passing period between classes, and then suddenly all the noise of the kids horse playing around me would stop, and I would find myself alone at my locker. And I would return, I would go to my next class and find out that I was 5 minutes late. So that quantum slipping was detected by 1980, and they tried to correct it. They also made an attempt to correct it in 1989 when I was pulled out of my first year of law school in order to go to Albuquerque and then drive to Socorro, New Mexico, where I participated in this technical activity involving a magnetosphere, this big, huge magnet. And Courtney Hunt told me that if I didn't go on that trip and participate in that technical activity, I would, quote-unquote, fall into the cosmic soup. You know, he said, well, I didn't say cosmic soup. He said, you're going to fall into the drink. And what I think they knew is that I was quantum slipping, and they were worried about me becoming quantum destabilized in a much more serious way. So, yes, there were quantum side effects that were evident when each time we returned to New Jersey in our original timeline.
All right. And go ahead.
Well, so Connie makes the statement in front of us, and my dad scowls at her like, Connie, I'm only sharing this stuff with you so you won't blab about it in front of Andy. Because my dad was trying to preserve the seamlessness of my life. He was trying to make sure that things evolved in real time as they knew they would, without any diverting selection pressure being artificially imposed by me having foreknowledge of what was going to be happening. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, so he was trying to maintain sort of the artisanal perfection or seamlessness of the arc of my own experience, right? Mm-hmm. Because they knew what I was destined to be involved in, but I didn't, and I wasn't supposed to. Unless they had made an executive decision, so, okay, let's tell Andy this so he can deal with it. And we know they've been doing that with at least the last four U.S. presidents. And I think on the last show with you, I described my meetings with both President Bushes when I was on the project, and then my accidental meeting with Barack Obama in 1982 when we were college students, mm-hmm. when they showed foreknowledge of the presidency. So in some instances, if the future event is serious enough and they can work with the person to positively prepare for and anticipate and accept the future event, they clearly had made a decision to sometimes apprise an individual what their destiny held. But in the main, they were supposed to keep that information secret because the person didn't need to know their own future.
Gotcha.
So, yeah.
And there's many things that we can touch upon and where we can go, so to speak, from here. You mentioned before in the first hour in this interview that 1981 you did a trip to Mars. Was that your first one? And if so, tell us a little bit about that.
Right. Well, yeah. The only remaining data point was when I was allowed to read my paper in 1971. So they clearly had a concern that they take the data from the future, from the paper, and fold it back in time and apprise me of what I was destined to find. That had clearly been prioritized as an intelligence community methodology. They clearly wanted to make young Andy aware of the fact that he was destined to reveal major data that's on Mars. And I think it was in the spirit of that kind of acclimation to the data that I was approached in the summer of 1981. And they put this career CIA officer in my life named Courtney M. Hunt. Courtney was a cousin of the Hunts of Texas, the prominent oil, you know, family, the Hunt dynasty of Texas, through their Orange County, California relations. And he had joined the CIA during the Korean War and participated in parachute drops into Korea. In fact, in one of them, he broke his back, so he had lower back trouble, I remember. And so he was career CIA. They put him in my life as sort of, I don't want to say a mentor, because his involvement in my life was ultimately pretty de minimis, but he was sort of a conduit or a briefing officer, so that if the government needed to, me to do something, or they needed to, like, for example, when they contacted me when I was in law school in 1989 and told me to get to New Mexico because I had to participate in some kind of technical activity, it was Courtney Hunt who called me and said, Andy, you know, the air bill is going to be sent to your box there at your apartment complex. You're going to New Mexico. It's not something we can argue about. You're going, you know, that we can discuss. Okay. So Hunt was, in a sense, my contact officer to CIA. He did some minimal training, and he also was, to some extent, investigating me. I can't say he was handling me, because his involvement in my life was not that substantial. It was more or less, he was the CIA guy in our town. And he was an adult acquaintance who sometimes trained me regarding something like this jump to Mars in 1981, and sometimes he was just sharing information with me. Sometimes he was asking me about my project experiences in the early 70s to answer a question that the CIA had about Project Pegasus. So he was simply an adult connected to the CIA that they put in my life that summer of 81. Throughout that early part of that summer, June, early July, he kept on asking the same question. Do you want to go to Mars? And I initially said, you mean on a rocket ship? And he looked at me like it was crazy. He said, you know how we can get people places? Maybe in a rocket ship. And I said, oh, yes, okay, so we're going to be teleporting there? And he goes, yeah, of course. And I really told him, no, I don't, why would I want to go to Mars? You know, why would I want to put my feet on Terra Incognita? You know, I didn't really view it as hugely scary, but it was certainly something that I had no desire to do. You know, I could see maybe going up, being an astronaut and going up, in the space shuttle or something. But the idea of going to Mars was unpleasant. It wasn't something that I longed to do. So I initially told him no.
What age were you here, by the way?
Huh?
What age were you when you got this question, by the way?
I turned 20 in September of 1981. So
20, okay.
This was, 19 years and 10 months. I was almost 20.
Mm.
And I was an adventuresome enough lad. I mean, I swam in the ocean, and I hiked in relatively remote locations when we were camping and stuff. I wanted to see the rest of the world, and I've tried to since then when I've been able to. But I didn't really want to become implicated in being on the surface of Mars, because one of my concerns was, what if I can't get back? I mean, there was a deracinating implication to it. It was rather than being terra firma or even the moon, and having seen those images of the Apollo astronauts on the moon, I thought, well, I could put on a spacesuit and go up on a rocket, maybe land on the moon like Armstrong and Aldrin did and the others. But the idea of going all the way to Mars and getting home, it just bespoke the possibility of being in a forbidding environment and being stuck there. And so it was just a set of circumstances I really didn't want to implicate myself in. So I told him no, but he kept on asking throughout the summer of 1981. And finally in July, I said, look, I'll go. Actually, we had a conversation where I said, Courtney, why do I have to go? And he said, because the survival of the human race depends on it.
Hmm.
And that really took me back, and I thought, well, you mean even if I die in transit or I perish there on the surface of Mars, it's for the best possible reason? And he said, yes. He said, Andy, it's not negotiable. You have to go. The key thing now is for you to psychologically prepare to go, because we're sending you.
Did they motivate that phrase with anything? The survival of the human race, did they tell you why?
No, but that's a direct quote. The discussion that I had with Hunt, in which I said, okay, I'm going, even though I'm not particularly welcoming on the idea of being on, terra incognita, as it were, on Mars, that conversation persuaded me to relent and say, okay, what do I need to train for this? Because, I had been a child, and I knew how they run you through these training programs. I mean, all of the quantum access things that we did in Pegasus, we would have these sort of colloquia on the front end, so I knew what I was going to be going through. I was going to be going through a little mini course on what to do and what to expect, and what to do in the case of an emergency and so forth. I knew that I had some summer schooling ahead of me that he would be at. This was held at over at California State University, Northridge. So I knew that, I had some specialized training ahead of me. And I guess because I was somewhat, I took some umbrage in the way in which these kinds of pressures and responsibilities had been placed on me in childhood when I was attached to Project Pegasus, I was pretty much just sick of dealing with the Defense Department. I mean, the reemerge, you know, them placing a CIA agent in my life and then him asking me, do you want to go to Mars? It was just like, okay, the feds are back and they want to run me through more, you know, through more stressful experiences. Yeah. I was kind of just avoiding getting tied up with them again. I had rejected my dad's insistence that I apply to the Naval Academy to get back into time travel activities under the Navy when I was in my, you know, when I was 16 or 17 years old, that time frame of applying to college. And so I was essentially not particularly eager to get involved with the Defense Department again. I'd already been there and, you know, done that. That's kind of how it was. It wasn't deep resentment and it wasn't profound fear. It was just like, kind of like, you know, why do you people have to be in my life again? Okay, so he's asking me whether I want to go to Mars. And we have that conversation and I kind of listened to that. And I thought, you know, by then, certainly my moral and philosophical development was advanced enough where I always thought that if, for example, in a natural disaster or an accident or something, I could sacrifice myself on behalf of my fellow human beings. I had thought about such philosophical questions. We had covered them in, obviously, in some of my college schooling. And I said, well, if it's that serious, if the survival of the human race depends on me going, I'll go. So then they ran me through some seminars at Cal State Northridge, but they were very minimal, okay? Some of it was just what I was going to be wearing, which was a crystal helmet with a communication and a respiration capability in it, just like the one that we had worn for that chronovisor probe in 71 up at ITT Defense.
Right.
So I was familiar with that. So he basically drove me in his car. I mean, I walked down from our home down to an intersection in Chatsworth, California, where we were living, and Hunt came up and picked me up, like just like he said he would. And we drove from Chatsworth to El Segundo. He parked the car, and we walked into this elevator up to the fifth floor that I've described, where there was like this counter with one man sitting there. And then he explained to me how the elevator was the jump room, and they put me up to the eighth floor or so, a couple more stories higher. And then we had that conversation on the intercom where I finally grew exasperated with the delay of going, and I said, Courtney, light this candle, and I went. And the only thing unusual about that particular form of quantum access was I mentioned how the elevator itself became sort of oblate. It didn't really become cylindrical, but it sort of began to morph from a rectilinear box-like shape into a quasi-cylindrical shape. And there was tremendous pressure on every square inch of my anatomy, just like there would be when you're scuba diving.
Mm, yeah.
Like, let's say, 40 feet below sea level or deeper. There was a sense of compression on my ears, my body, you know, my face, everywhere. And then that relented, and the jump room resumed its normal shape and opened. And it opened in an underground bunker that had been explained to me during my training. It was basically one story below ground. I had actually seen, you know, images of it. And there was a stone stairwell on the right side, just like you'd have in an ancient castle. And I was instructed to leave the elevator and go to the right and walk up this stone staircase. And at the top of the staircase, now at ground level, there was a little dugout area, sort of a small room, that was at the back of the eye sockets of a large skull that was on the surface of Mars. Mm. And as instructed, I walked through the eye sockets and out onto the surface. And there greeting me was an ordinary human being, about 25 years of age. He was a white male with some stubble growth of beard, like he had been on the surface of Mars, let's say, for several weeks without shaving. And I was yelling at him, can I take my helmet off? Because he clearly didn't have a helmet on. And he was laughing and saying yes. And I think he was probably laughing because I was shouting, and in fact, I'd forgotten that I had a microphone in the helmet. So it was probably booming, you know, he was hearing me yell, you know, can I take my helmet off? So I took my helmet off, and the atmosphere of Mars was breathable, but I kind of breathed in quickly, almost like you do when you're hyperventilating, because the atmosphere of Mars has oxygen in it, but less oxygen. And it kind of strained my lungs like a smoggy city does at the end of a hot, smoggy summer day, where the alveoli in your lungs are sort of aching.
Hmm.
and kind of a smog lung kind of sensation. And yet I was able to breathe. But during that trip, and particularly the second jump to Mars that I undertook with Hunt in August of 81, my legs became very fatigued. So there had to have been oxygen deprivation. The other thing I remember, there was a very spacey feeling. I felt spaced out the more time I spent on the surface of Mars. So after I arrived there, then a female and a male walked up. They were around the same age as this guy, early 20s, mid-20s. And I just sort of hung out there. The girl even smoked at one point, so her lungs were clearly adapted to the lower oxygen levels. And I remember when I later asked Hunt how we were able to breathe on Mars if there was only the sparsest vegetation on the ground. On Mars, you have this rust-red soil, but you have these little tiny plants that look like almost like little weeds that are popping up on the ground. Like you see mosses and lichen, but also little sort of fern-like and little sedge-like plants that dot the landscape. Just like when you're hiking in the desert around Sedona, New Mexico, and you've got that red soil, a dark rust-red soil, and these little sedges and stuff that are cropping up. So the girl actually took out a cigarette and began smoking, which is sort of like, you could tell I was totally spaced out of my mind because I was on the surface of another planet and kind of adjusting to it psychologically.
Yes.
And after about an hour, I said, am I free to go now? And he said, yes, you can go. Actually, I said at one point, can I go? And then they didn't say anything. And then I said it again, am I free to go? And they didn't say anything. And then after about an hour, I said again, look, can I get out of here and go back to Earth? And he said, yes, you can go. And as instructed, I walked through the skull, through the eye sockets of the skull, down the staircase, and back into the jump room. And I sat in the jump room there in the corner, actually sitting down in the elevator-like contraption there, for about, I don't know, a half hour, maybe 45 minutes. And then finally, the doors abruptly closed, and I had a similar experience, and it opened up in the office building in El Segundo.
It's easier to
Mars that way than it was to fly from. I recently flew from Portland, Oregon to Anchorage, Alaska, and that was more exhausting than teleporting to Mars.
How about that? Yeah, I guess one thing that occurred to me, not the cigarette smoke here, but what did it smell like? Was there any difference in terms of smell on Mars?
It smelled different. It smelled somewhat, I don't want to say sulfuric because that has the wrong implication. It smelled mustier than oxygen, than the atmosphere on Earth. It smelled more sort of mineral rich. It almost had like a gunpowder smell.
Hmm.
And I was thinking about something else about that up there. I'm trying to think of what it
is. Like a burnt almost? Like it's like a deserty type?
More like a chemical smell. More like a gunpowder smell. That's the best that I can describe.
Huh.
And also, it's not all red. And the sky was slightly blue.
Yeah.
It was a very light blue. What I remembered was I asked Hunt where the oxygen is coming from, and he said the lithosphere. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, we think that oxygen, since the disaster there, that oxygen has been gradually seeping out of the rocks on Mars. But it smelled slightly flinty, like when you use a flint to start a fire.
Right.
Yeah, slightly dynamite-ish or gunpowder-ish.
Do you briefly want to just mention if you know anything about what actually happened there then? Was it we've heard ideas from various researchers and people about cataclysms, so to speak, in our solar system, and Mars was one of these planets that was affected by this as well. Are you talking about the same event here, or did something else happen up there? Do you know?
I'm adhering to the theory regarding, and I've been talking about it, and the evidence that I saw on Mars, personally being up there, and also obviously resulting from now analyzing photographs, which is obviously really a more sort of de minimis activity, because I was able to walk around there for a few hours and get a sense of what Mars looks like. And that's now informing a lesser function that I'm performing, which is to take NASA's photographs and analyze them. But what I saw there, and also what I'm finding in the NASA and European Space Agency photographs of Mars, conforms to one of the leading theories of cosmology of our solar system, which is that around 9500 BC, debris elements from the Vela supernova explosion came into our solar system, and they struck a planet that mathematics indicates should be where the asteroid belt is. And this debris also struck Mars and pummeled the surface of Mars. So you can see large boulders. In certain locations on Mars, there are these massive boulders that have been laid down, just like a giant hand threw them down on the ground like marbles. And they're actually sitting in the soil. But you can clearly see that there are huge meteorites that entered the Martian atmosphere and landed in on the surface. Mars was pummeled during that, and there was major damage to its biosphere. It was also fractured. And I think some of these large worms that we're seeing are actually glassine engineering projects to fill the seams of a fractured Mars.
Hmm.
I'm conjecturing that the deep underground military base construction on Earth may be a contingency plan for the possibility that Mars may actually fragment as a result of that 9500 BC event. That may also explain why the humanoids on Mars are seeking to come to Earth. That's all conjectural, however. I have no direct evidence that that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
But Mars was pummeled and squished into an oblate spheroid, more oblate than planet Earth, which is also an oblate spheroid. We're not living on a perfect sphere. It's
right.
Kind of squished. But Mars is even more squished and was devastated by that. And it was that celestial event that ended the great maritime civilization on Earth that built the Great Pyramid, the Sphinx, and the great platform at Baalbek in Lebanon, which was the spaceport of that civilization. And the linkage between that ancient Egyptian and ancient Mars civilization is not only found in the work of individuals like Hoagland, Barra, and Hancock, and Boval, but now in my work, under the aegis of the Mars Anomaly Research Society, we just published a paper that shows the intaglio of the head of a pharaoh on the edge of a rock on Mars, so that when you look closely at this edge of the rock, you have clearly the identifiable head of a pharaoh with the cobra ready to strike motif of Wadjet, which was the lord protector of Lower Egypt that became the protector of, you know, the dynastic Egypt under the pharaohs. And when you look at that corner, the corner of the rock is clearly a pyramid. So this pharaoh is actually sitting in front of a pyramid shape, very much like the Sphinx is located. And it's undeniably a rock carving or intaglio. It may even be a stamp in an artificial substance. We're not sure it's a rock. It may be a piece of metal. But it's a sunken image of the head and hat and chest of a pharaoh. It's a bust of a pharaoh, just like the iconic bust of Nefertiti that the German archaeologist Gustav Borchardt found at Amarna, Egypt in 1912, which is now in the Berlin Museum in Germany. So it's a classic image of an Egyptian pharaoh. So that's some of the significance of the work that we're doing at Mars right now, is we're proving this theory that there was this ancient connection. I might add there was another major figure in this area, which was Karl Munk, studying the D&M pyramid site south of the face on Mars at Cydonia, established that the allocation of monuments there is consistent with similar sites found at the Giza site in Egypt, at Avebury in England, and at Washington, D.C.
Yes.
So the Masonic tradition that links ancient Egypt, medieval England, and the modern United States civilization actually replicated an allocation of monuments that's at or near the Cydonia site. So we must cite the significant work done by Karl Munk in collaboration with Richard Hoagland to verify that site on Mars. My point is that the photo analysis of the data from the Mars rover's Spirit and Opportunity is now capturing things like literally an image from that Egyptian civilization, the intaglio of the bust of a pharaoh. And that's what makes the Mars research we're doing so exciting. We're literally finding the fingerprint of that Egyptian civilization on stone monuments on Mars.
Yes.
So now we have both the micro and the macro evidence establishing that ancient connection. So that was an interplanetary federation that linked Earth and Mars and probably another planet, and that federation was destroyed during that event.